Welcome to a Frugal Athlete podcast, where we interview athletes, both current and former, on the prudent financial practices and smart career decisions they are making. In these episodes, we dive into what it means to be a frugal athlete. You might think that frugal just means being cheap, but as you will soon learn, being frugal is more complex than that. Hey, what's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of a Frugal Athlete podcast. We have a very special guest today, David Zhope. When it comes to the pronunciation, I literally offline, me and David spent 3 minutes speaking about how I pronounce his last name. And the reason why I tell you that story is not only because it's important to make great first impressions, which David and myself did, but it's important to remember names. Before I go on a tangent, let me introduce you to David. David is a serial entrepreneur, and I do not want to disrespect him because he does so many more things. He's an active angel, head of investor relations at Alchemist Accelerator. Prior to that, he ran ops and deal flow at On Deck Angels. Outside of this, he's an avid swimmer, experimentalist, writer. He has his own personal blog, Cup of Joe, which is a play on his last name, as we obviously previously alluded to. And I'm not sure if he's gonna announce it. Maybe he will announce it, but he has a new concept developing. So yeah, I didn't say athlete, but there's gonna be so many unique things that we can take away from David that I'm excited about because of not only his athlete experience growing up, but some of the things that he's currently doing and a lot of things that athletes are looking to do, whether it's throughout their career, during their career, or post-career. So that was a long-winded answer to say we are very excited to have David on this podcast, on this show. Take out your notebooks because you're going to learn a lot. David, how are you doing today?
I am doing well. I love the introduction. And I will say, out of all the podcasts I've been on, we've probably spent the most amount of time trying to figure out how my last name is pronounced. And I deeply, deeply appreciate it. That just goes to show how much OB you care about the people that you have on this.
No, most definitely. And I know it's been a long time coming, but originally we met at a soccer game, which kind of ties us all this in together, like the world of sports, the world of connection. Tell us your story. How did you get to where you are now?
So, we did meet at a soccer game. One of our mutuals was inviting us out. And it was actually the first time I sat field side at a soccer game. And it's so interesting because we're having this conversation. I don't know when you plan to publish this, but we're having this conversation the day after Messi announced that he's going to play for Inter Miami, which goes to the business mindedness of all this as well. You're the expert there. I'm not going to like pretend to be an expert in the world of soccer, but I think it's really fascinating how the world is changing altogether. How did I make my way into this like wonderful world of investing and all? I went to college in Berkeley, and I'm sure people can figure this out, but in Berkeley, even if you don't want to, you're going to be entrepreneurial minded because everyone there is thinking about entrepreneurship, thinking about investing. The fact that we have some of the largest like entrepreneurship classes, as well as just like people who graduate and go on to become entrepreneurs. I don't know the ranking at the top of my head. I haven't looked at it recently, but when I was in school, Berkeley was ranked first out of all the entrepreneurs that graduate from the school. Mm-hmm. So naturally, you're bled into this world. And you mentioned I was a serial entrepreneur. I love building things. And some of the things may not be like technical in nature in the sense of like venture software related things, yeah. But nevertheless, I love building things. You mentioned also I'm building some new concept. I'll give a teaser. Building a card game, but it'll eventually come out. I don't want to spoil too much just yet. So I love building things and I love working with entrepreneurs, and I made my merry way into the world of venture 2016. This is after our last last venture I was a part of. We exited, there's a bunch of liquidation, and then I found my way into the world of Skydeck, where we ended up raising a $25 million fund to invest in Berkeley entrepreneurs. And that was my foray into the wonderful world of venture. Fell in love with the industry largely because, you know, it's so rewarding seeing the underdogs truly win and to be able to help them. I always say there, as an investor, there's two ways you can invest. One is to get picked. Two is to pick, right? And getting picked is great if you have accolades, pedigree, whatnot in the venture world, operational experience, expertise. But one of the ways that is fairly fascinating is how to pick. And that is either going early or going into the non-obvious. And we obviously at Skydeck often bet on people who are non-obvious. And oftentimes are early, still in the research days. And to support these underdogs and help them become phenomenal institutions is really exciting. For example, I know Skydeck boasts about this a lot, but I was there when Toby and Brad pitched a Lime Bike at our demo day to everyone else. And it was just so awesome trying to see them tackle this bike sharing world when bike sharing wasn't even that interesting or popular in the US at the time. But nevertheless, as we know, they've gone on to do amazing things.
How do you identify talent? And I know, like we said before, there's a lot of synergy between your experience, your background, what you're doing now to the athlete world. So when we think about athletes, young athletes, how do scouts identify young athletes to know that they're going to go pro? How do you identify, talked about getting in early, getting into the non-obvious? I wrote that down because I really love that. But what are some like key like characteristics, tangible assets that you look for when you're looking for that deal flow?
So there are a couple things, and I'm happy to be more tactical here as well for your audience. So a lot of investors index on passion and grit, which is very true. Like as an entrepreneur, you're going to have to go through 10 to 15 miracles before you go from inception to IPO, right? And you need to conquer them every single time. So if you have grit, you can overcome them. And so I'll share a couple things. The first thing I look for is I ask every entrepreneur I end up backing, what is your selfish motivation? What's your selfless motivation? Selfless motivation is where you go to the press. It's the thing that's on TechCrunch front page, Forbes. It's all the stuff like, I want to change the world. This is great. Yeah. This your selfless motivation is going to drive you on your best of days, right? When you're doing really well in a bull market, it's going up and to the right. You're going to love it. You're going to brag about people. This is how you're going to acquire the best talent. That's really how it's going to go, right? But to me, because I bet so early on, I'm first check investor. I invest before any institutional investor. I'm looking for things that will keep that founder going even in the worst of times. And the worst of times is really a selfish motivation. What are you trying to do? Right? Are you trying to get dinner on the dinner table? Are you trying to prove someone wrong or something wrong, some notion wrong? I want that chip on the shoulder. And it's asking about that selfish motivation, because on the worst of days, when things are just going wrong and like nothing's going up and to the right, in fact, it's going like to the bottom or like, you know, it's declining. I need to know that you're in it for the long run, right? I need to know that this is your life's purpose. And it may not need to be like, I'm going to try to change the world, touch a billion people's lives. I just need to know that you want to prove your parents wrong, or you want to like, you know, prove some high school bully wrong, or you want to just make money, right? Like you grew up in poverty and you're like, I just need to make, and like, I need to prove that in our family, despite not coming from the most successful background, our parents didn't come from wealth. I'm going to make sure my parents have a really comfortable living because they provided so much for me and they're entrepreneurs I've backed there. So selfish and selfless motivation are really important to me. The other thing for is a proxy for entrepreneurship, right? I often back, and I'll back a lot of like first-time entrepreneurs, having invested in second-time, third-time entrepreneurs. I have a lot of investors love backing serial entrepreneurs just because you make all your mistakes on the first time around, so you're not making mistakes on their dime. But I love investing in first-time entrepreneurs because, I mean, you see some of the best businesses out there, right? Like for Zuckerberg, Facebook was his first business, first jobs, this, like, you know, Apple was his first business, right? For outsized returns and really the drive, there are a lot of founder-led companies that have done very, very well. And so one of the things I use for proxy for entrepreneurship is I don't want this venture to be the first time you've even thought about doing something new, right? And so one of the questions I ask founders all the time is, what have you done in your last role that no one else has done, right? And so that is a good proxy for, oh, have you done things outside the fold, even when you're in a traditional role or a role that everyone is a part of, right? Yeah. And so for athletes, that could be, and one of the things I do love investing in is, I mentioned grit at the beginning. I love investing in former athletes, veterans, former chefs. All of these industries have one thing in common, which is you have to be really gritty because things will not go as you expect, right? Because you can put in 10x input and not get 10x output. And it really is that 80-20 hour law rule kind of thing, the Pareto principle. So I look for excellence, but I also look for evidence of early entrepreneurship. So that's something I look for. And hopefully that's helpful for your audience. But a couple of things I look for as an investor.
Now, those are great conversation starters, but also questions that make you dig deep. You know, as athletes, whether they're starting something or investing in different projects, obviously you have to do your due diligence, but getting deeper into the person or the founder or the company, that's really important. Because on the other side, when we're playing and we go through the combines, these are what coaches are asking us, but sometimes translates into us deploying our own capital well, we think the deal is going to have an outsized return and we're just putting in money. So I love these questions that you asked. And I think it's really important as an athlete to, you know, follow your footsteps when it comes to that. You spoke about, you know, some of the things that you use, you know, you grew up an avid swimmer and some of the principles that you talk about on your blog as it relates to building things, investing in things, bringing people together. What are some principles that you've used and learned from your athletic background that you apply today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have two things in particular that I always reference, which this might be like particular to the swimming world. But the hardest part about swimming, there's two things that's really hard about swimming. One, getting in the water. Two, getting out of the water. those are the two hardest things. Oh. And analogized to the role of startups, starting a business, going from zero to one, that cold start problem is usually the hardest thing, right? And so understanding what the motivation is before you jump into the water, because the water is cold. The water is like, you know, not friendly. It might be raining outside. It's not cool. And you know, as soon as you jump in, you have to do this really hard warm-up set. Like back when I was swimming, our warm-up set was like 2000 yards. And that's give or take like 80 laps. Actually, that is exactly 80 laps. And that's just warm-up, right? And you have this whole set in front of you and you have to like, given I was waking up for 5 a.m. practices and after school, we were doing like 3 p.m. as well as like 6 p.m. practices. And on average, I was during season, I was swimming like 6 to 8 hours a day, which I know it's insane. And so every time getting in the water, you have to really convince yourself this is why you're getting into the water, right? You have to look at a goal that's further than just yourself, some goal that's larger than yourself, right? If you're waking up at 4:30 a.m. to go to 5 a.m. practice, you're not going to enjoy every second, right? And no one jumps into swimming like, oh, yeah, just enjoy. And I imagine it's the same for soccer, basketball, football, whatever. Right? You have to work really hard for that, right? So the hardest thing is starting, right? And so understanding what the motivation is by starting. So I always ask, what is their origin story? Why do they name the company the way they name it, right? What does that name mean to them? Why do they start it? Did they come up with it in a business class? I'm like, hey, you know what? We saw a large market, $1 billion market, $1 trillion market, and that's what we're tackling it. Or is it because something that's deeply important to them? Have they spent time in the idea maze? And for folks who are not familiar with the concept of idea maze, I would just Google Balaji Srinivasan or Chris Dixon and then Idea Maze. And they've written some really great pieces about the founders that they like backing. Both of these are like Andreessen Horowitz fame, that you want to back founders who have spent time thinking, breathing, making mistakes in this maze. And eventually that startup is a function of all their previous accolades, previous experiences altogether, right? So that's one. The second thing is, so I'm a long distance swimmer. Or I was a long distance swimmer. Or now I just like swim recreationally, right? But as a long distance swimmer, the hardest thing is, you know, like the later lengths, right? The back half, right? Yeah. The first half is always, you have so much energy. You're like, okay, I'm going pumping. And I have some friends who are just like, they sprint out. Like, so for example, let's say you're swimming 400 meters, right? You sprint out in the first 100 meters and you're like dead for the next 300 meters. Yeah. And some people do really well. They just go a really strong, like first leg. And then after that, they're like dead. And one of my coaches, this is way, way, way back when I was like just on the advent of like making Junior Olympics and Far Western times and all that. He was like, you should always break every race into four pieces. The first leg, second leg, third leg, and fourth leg. The first leg, don't go 100%, right? You should put like 75% effort in. The second leg, you ramp it up a little bit more. You put like 80%, 85% effort in. The last leg, you should put a 90%. The third one, you put in like 90%. Last one, put in 100%, right? Or 110%, right? And all of it equates effectively to like 85% and 90% overall if you average it out. Yeah. But the reason for that is you have to taper yourself in the very beginning. Measure your pace, right? Don't burn out at the very beginning. Know what it's like to like have a good pace, right? And to train for that, if you're swimming 400 meters, always practice with 800 meters or double that, 1600 meters, right? Because then you teach yourself that this long distance isn't that long, right? 400 meters sounds long to a sprinter, but if you swim 800 meters every single time, like 10 sets of 800 meters in practice, 400 meters is going to seem like a breeze, right? Yeah. And in a very similar wavelength for founders, what that means for the first leg is you have to like, don't think about 2, 3, 4, 5 year horizons. Think about like 10 year horizons, right? And I know Jeff Bezos had this quote a long time ago, and I'm paraphrasing here, so don't quote me exactly, but he was all like, if everyone is on this 3 to 5 year time horizon, and I'm on this 7 to 9 year horizon, I know I'm going to win because I'm going to outlast everyone else, right? And mm-hmm. as a founder, and when you're looking for that, and when you're betting on founders, you have to look for people who have a long time horizon, that they're going to be in the industry for the long term. Right now, we're in this Gen AI hype. Also earlier this week, in terms of recording, Apple announced their Vision Pro, and now every VC, I'm sure in the next like couple months, we're going to see every VC like, hey, we pivoted our thesis to AR, VR. We're going to see so many founders doing AR and VR and all that, right? And that could be totally fine. But if they have like a 2-3 year time horizon where they plan to exit within 5 years, that's probably not an entrepreneur worth backing, right? Versus if they really believe that this is the long-term trajectory of the human race, then that might be more interesting. So that's the other thing. The second part of this first, second, third, fourth leg is the third leg in a race is always the hardest, because that's when you start running out of energy. And that's when it's a mental game. You start playing. That's like, I'm sure this is like the third quarter in a basketball game or something like that, right? It's the hardest because it's no longer who's trained harder. Because everyone, when you get to the world-class stage, everyone trains equally as hard. Everyone does the same reps in the gym. No one's slacking, right? No world-class athlete is slacking. So the third leg all becomes a mental game. And can your mentality outlast the other folks? And so one thing I really look for is, once again, back to the grit thing. When it comes to the third leg, are they self-aware? Do they know what's coming? And are they prepared for that? And one of the questions I like asking is, if in 18 months you were to wildly succeed, like what would that look like? What is the most likely contributor to it? If in 18 months you're going to fail, right? You're going to close up shop, you're going to go bankrupt. Like, what is the most likely reason as to why you're failing, right? And so be self-aware, what is your greatest strength, but also what is your greatest risk, is really important as a founder as well.
And that's a lovely breakdown, because I love how you're using like terminologies that can relate back to sports and, you know, just make it easily digestible. I really think that's important. So let's get into what you're doing currently. You know, you mentioned your blog, you know, content is a big part of what you do. You know, as athletes, we are, you know, there's a couple of us that are in this space of creator economy, athlete, entrepreneur. How do you go about, you know, making content for your blog?
Oh, this is a fascinating question. I just had a really long discussion with a friend of mine who I would characterize as much better of a content creator than I am. So as a content creator, in my opinion, there's two kinds of content creators. There's artists and there's designers. Artists create as a reflection of themselves. It's self-expression, right? Designers create because there's an audience in mind. There's a product they want to get to. There's an industry they want to get to. So they create for other folks, not for themselves, but for others. As an entrepreneur, you always start from a personal problem, or I like to bet on folks who start from a personal problem. So you always start as an artist, but by the time you get to the seed, usually when you get to product market fit, or maybe even to pre-seed stage, when you get to that early adopter audience, you're expanding to a designer. You're no longer solving the problem just for yourself, but you're solving the problem for other folks. And I think it's similarly true in the world of content creation, right? You have to know if you're an artist or a designer, and you have to stick to your guns that way. In various ways, a lot of content creators, like, they start off as artists, or some people start off as designers, right? Everyone writes a Substack because they want, I want to cover the top 10 topics in AI in the industry. Yeah. I want to cover the top 5 topics this week in venture capital, right? That's a designer. You're creating for someone else. You're not necessarily creating for yourself. For me, and this is like, you know, everyone has a different formula here. For me, being a designer and solely being a designer without being an artist is a recipe for disaster. There's a massive graveyard, and I'm sure you know this as well, of people who have written less than 10 blog posts or produced less than 10 podcast episodes, right? Because they start off designing for an audience, but they don't find a personal interest in it. It's like the MBA student, not to trash any MBA students, but it's an MBA student who finds an idea in class, finds a big market, it's like, I'm going to do this idea, and then realizes it's so much harder than they thought it would be, and they give up. And so as a content creator, one of the things I think about is, I've always started my blog as an expression for me to write. I believe I am better in my written language format than in my verbal language format. And so because of that, me writing things down helps me have more robust thought. And then I translate that into like verbiage, right? And so that's really helpful for me. And when I started off as a content creator, like when I'm going back to like the swimming analogy, the hardest thing about swimming is to get in the pool, right? For me, I was like, you know what? Am I going to commit to like every single week for the next 5-10 years? I don't know, right? That sounds like a lot of work. And if I'm going to do a weekly, what if I miss out on a week? What if I need to go on a vacation? What if I'm just burnt out, right? And so one of my mentors told me when I started my blog was, before you publish anything, write 20 pieces put 20 pieces on the back end and they'll always be your plan B. So in case you have, like, you're writing on a weekly cadence and you run out of things to write about, you can pull from one of those 20, right? And having that plan B, or at least having the assurance that there is a plan B, helps you not get burnt out as a content creator, because there's always something to fall back on, right? That said, of the first 20 pieces I wrote before I started my blog, I've only used 2 to date. And I started my blog back in 2019.
Unbelievable. So what's that secret?
So the secret is, like, just having the comfort. It's like, hey, you know what? Let's say I'm really tired this week. Or I can, like, you know what? I just can't, right? I always have something to rely on. The second part is something I learned. So when I write a blog post, I write weekly at this point, but I don't start and end the blog post every single week. Every blog post takes on anywhere between 2 to 3 weeks. I start it. So one of the tricks, and people might find me a bit weird, I know a lot of my friends find me weird. I have a whiteboard in my shower.
How do you write on it? Because I got a whiteboard right here, and it's one of the best investments I made to date.
It is great. So I take my shower thoughts very seriously. How it works is, first thing, every time I move to a new place or every time I get a place, I'm like, all right, you know what? I've got to get the biggest shower area. Like, I got to get a good bathroom. That's really important to me, right? And so my
double
shower area,
sinks, like big bathtub, all that, huh?
Oh yeah, I get all. So I actually prefer shower. So I don't do bathtubs, but shower. Then you can, like, bathtub, there's a limited size unless you get a jacuzzi or whatnot, right? Yeah. But I'm not that wealthy yet, so to speak, yet. But I like my showers. And so my shower area is very long. So when I'm showering on one side, and then there's the whiteboard on the other side. The second thing is get rainproof markers, right? You can buy it from like 20, 30 bucks on Amazon and all that. And you effectively write on the whiteboard. Is it completely smudge proof? No. But as an artist in my very, very early days of my life, because I'm left-handed, right? And you smudge as you write, you smudge as you draw. So my teacher taught me to, like, levitate while writing. And so I'm able to not smudge. Nevertheless, rainproof markers, whiteboard. I will also caveat, and I apologize to all the climate folks out there, I might be the single biggest reason California is in a drought, but I take good long showers. I pay my dues for PG&E, but I take my good showers. And the great thing about that is, when your pores open up, when the steam is all there, it's the equivalent of being in a sauna, your creative mind tends to, like, really jump around a lot. You start making connections everywhere because you have nothing else to distract you. No phone, no device to distract you, except for water and what's in front of you. And what's in front of me is the whiteboard. So I start all my creative ideas at night when I shower. And I write it all down. I translate that all into bullet points when I get out of the shower on my blog. And then over the course of 2-3 weeks, you always go through the cycle of, I have the best idea ever. Oh, shoot, this is the worst idea ever. Somebody's already written about this. Oh, actually, it's not that bad. I have a nuance to this. Actually, it's like somebody else has written a nuance about this. And it's like this roller coaster ride. And eventually, every time you go through these chapters, these stepwise functions, your idea becomes more robust and your thinking becomes more robust. So at the end of 3 weeks, you have a very constructed, thought out framework of an article. And that probably is the result of conversations, inputs, outputs that you've had over the past couple of weeks. So that's how I do it. But because of that, I, like, at this point, I'm like, let's see, if I pull up my blog right now, I have 22 drafts open right now. And I just, these are just random things I start throughout time.
I'm like trying to see, like, I'm trying to, like, think of my setup. I'm like, yo, because there's so many things that you're like, all right, I got to, like, try to remember in my brain. So I'm, like, telling it to myself multiple times. So right when I get out the shower, I put in my notes. But you have the whiteboard in the shower.
I do. It helps so much. It's a game changer. Try it, Obi. If it doesn't work, let me know. But I think it's worth trying for at least a month.
Okay. Yeah, most definitely. Are there any other tricks that you would recommend as it pertains to, like, content or just, like, you know, building, networking, you know, as you yourself, you're an ambitious young gentleman. You know, a lot of athletes, both male and female, are looking to build their empires. What are some other productivity tips, you know, level up tips that you would recommend?
I have so many. We could probably talk for 5 hours if I went through every single one, if not longer. I'll share 2 others that might be helpful. One is have a handwritten journal everywhere I go. I journal every day, and it's really important. It's more important to journal, in my opinion, physically than to, like, take it on, like, your notes app on your iPhone or, like, the Google Keep app on if you're Android. But the reason I think it's more important to write it down physically is there's lots of studies this, and you can look at Stanford, Columbia, you name it kind of thing, where if you write things down physically, you're more likely to remember them. And that's very, very helpful. That's one, journal. Second thing is I mentioned that I'm starting a cardium. So this is a fairly recent development, to be fair. You can buy a stack of like 500 blank playing cards on Amazon for like $8 or something, or $10. And so what I do is everywhere I go, I don't know if like you have a I don't know if this is video format or audio format only. So this is both. Okay. Yeah. So for those on video, I have the virtual background on, but I have blank playing cards everywhere I go, and I keep in my pocket. So every time I have an idea about something that could go in a card game or something that like is ephemeral but is creative, I see something on the street or something, I will just draw it out. I write it out on the playing card. It's super easy. You can keep it in your wall. You keep a couple in your wall. Keep like five in my wall at a time, right? And that helps you capture ideas and not let it disappear into the cosmos. So those are like two productivity creative hacks that I have everywhere I go. And every single day, journal. And even if you can't fill a whole page of a journal entry, leave the rest of the page open, because then it gives your brain space and air to think about things, right? Don't just feel like, oh, I only have one sentence to write about today, so I'm going to put tomorrow's entry like right below today's entry. Leave the whole page open, because someday in the future, you'll think about it again, you'll revisit, and you'll actually have a lot more ideas to supplement the initial one sentence, the one word that I have, right? So those are two in terms of like productivity, creativity. You also mentioned relationships. So I work in venture capital, and what that effectively means is we are very much a relationship-driven industry. There's only so many people, like at some point, probably if you're a year in, maybe 2 years into the world here, that you're probably going to be at most a second degree connection from anyone you possibly want to meet. And this is like going from like Kevin Bacon's like 6 degrees of freedom all the way down to like 2 degrees, right? It's a tight industry. And so the most important thing is we often tell this to a lot of angel investors and LPs as well. It's not about who you know, because everyone knows everyone, right? It's about how well you know them and how much they keep you top of mind. And so having a really good CRM tool is really good. So for me, my CRM tool is Airtable. I've used every CRM. I kid you not, I once called up Salesforce's like customer support. I was like, hey, you know what? I'm not buying this for my team. I just need a one seat. I just need one seat for this. Can I just try out Salesforce? I don't know if Salesforce is ever going to be a sponsor for you, so I apologize to them in advance. It's not meant for personal CRM. It is not meant for that. Anyways, I tried it out. So I tried everything from UpHabit to First Contact to Cabal, everything. And I realized the level of customizability for all these are not that great. And what I really like is really customizing like my messages to people. And so mine's all on Airtable, pieced together with Zapier. So if you don't know any code, Zapier is this great low code, no code tool you can piece together. And what effectively means every time I trigger something in my Airtable, it automatically sends an email or a WhatsApp message to folks. And so they're timing wise, there are certain things. In my CRM, my CRM is in the same Airtable as my bucket list. So every time someone recommends me something, I go like, oh, I got to do this. So recently I was chatting with a brilliant guy who recommended, since I was thinking a lot about games and all that, right? Yeah. He recommended, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Octalis, I don't know. My English is not good. OCTALYSIS framework for game design. And I put it in my bucket list.
Is your bucket list on Airtable as well?
Bucket list on Airtable as well. And so these Airtables are connected. And so he recommended me that, as soon as I read that article, which is like this, I don't know, 5-page article or whatnot, then I wrote my reaction on Airtable. And as soon as I checked completed on my bucket list, it automatically sent him emails like, hey, thank you for recommending this. Here's my reaction to it. If you have any other recommendations in this wavelength, there we go. Right.
So how did you send that email via Airtable? Because I'm on Airtable right now. I'm on Notion. I definitely agree that every individual should have their own personal CRM database, whether anyone you meet, categorize them, customize it to your personal preference. So I really appreciate you recommending that. And we're going to definitely have that in the description if anyone would like to see.
If Airtable is ever going to sponsor you, this is a great ad for them.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to send it to them.
Airtable and Zapier. So I use Airtable and Zapier. So Zapier is this no-code tool where you can string together different apps to produce like results without needing any code, right? So just like logic steps. And so what happens is I have different triggers on my Airtable, right? And so when someone recommends me something, it automatically goes under their name. And the tab, like the column, it's like a single select column. It's like not started slash incomplete, work in progress, and completed, right?
Yeah.
And so when it goes from not completed to completed, and there's a trigger that does an extra yes, because in case they accidentally trigger something, I don't want like me to just send like spam people with emails. So there's always two triggers for everything, right? There's a column that says yes or no, like, do I agree that an email should be sent? Another column is, incomplete, work in progress, complete. And when it changes to completed, as well as a trigger of yes, I want to send this email, it sends an automated email to that email address of the person who recommended that thing to me. And so that's one of those things. Another thing that's really helpful on Airtable is I take a lot of notes and just like of people's interests, fun facts, all this kind of stuff, right? As it comes up in conversation. Every Thanksgiving, I send anywhere between like 200 to 300 Thanksgiving letters of people who have like impacted my life in some way. And one of the great things is start writing Thanksgiving letters as soon as someone shares something insightful with you or helps you with something that's really instrumental to your career or life at that stage, right? And so when Thanksgiving happens, there's an automatic kind of Zapier trigger that triggers all those thank you letters on Thanksgiving to those people. And so it's a pleasant surprise to everyone who's like impacted your life in some sort of way during that year.
I am going to set up some time with you to have a breakdown of this Airtable Zapier connection.
I'm always happy to. I nerd out about this kind of stuff to the best of my abilities.
This is amazing. And it just goes to show you how, if you cultivate and you massage your relationships, the benefit down the road, and obviously we're not trying to say make everything transactional because you're not, but you cultivate, you massage the relationships, the intimacy of the relationship is just going to be that much more. And people are going to be way more willing to work with you. You're going to be on top of mind. So I really appreciate that, because in this world, as we know, the world is very big, but it's very small at the same time. And reputation matters, brand matters, character matters. And these are different things that you can do to help organize that, but also help cultivate that. So absolute game changers.
It's about having fun, right? Like, it's not all about work. And I understand, like, you know, there's this term, and I hate using it, but it's a term everyone uses, networking. And networking is frankly just like you're a node on someone else's network. It's often transactional. Like we're also recording this like right after we both live in like the like, you know, Northern California. But last week we had SF Tech Week, and SF Tech Week, as you might imagine, everyone's hosting events, everyone's hosting happy hours and networking events and all that. And I show up to a couple just to support some friends. And everyone's there for transactions. They go like, what do you do for a living? And I go to all these LPGP events, which are like limited partner and general partner, which is like people who invest in venture capital and people who are venture capitalists, right? People who are venture capitalists want money from people who want to invest in venture capital. And so it often is like, hey, are you an LP or are you a GP? Or a GP? Okay, move on. Like they just like ignore you, right? Which is hilarious, because you go to like the VC founder events and it's the exact opposite, because then everyone wants the GP's attention. Everyone wants like the general partner, the VC's attention. But when you're in these LP-GP networking effects, it's like, oh, you're another GP? Well, good to meet you. We'll talk later. I need to go find some LPs, right? And if you mention you're an LP, they will try to take your attention for as long as possible. And it's always like, oh, I'm raising another fund. Can you write me $250K, $500K, $1 million check thing? And it's often the selling thing. And the thing I dislike and want the industry to change, and this is why I'm doing a lot of things on the back end as well, is soon, let's say, Obi, you're an LP, right? And I'm raising a fund. And I go, like, Obi, I need $1 million from you. And you're like, all right, David, I'm convinced. I like your thesis. I'm going to invest in you. Give me $1 million. I forget about you until the next time I like fundraise. Because I also honestly don't think a lot of VCs have good CRM tools. They ask founders to have good CRM tools, but a lot of VCs don't have good CRM tools. And they mean to. They're goodwill, but it's just like when you're busy with investing in so many other things, you often forget about those LP relationships over time, even though they're the ones who backed you in the early days. The equivalent of if you're a founder, you forget who your pre-seed investor, you forget who your angel investor is, right? Not intentional. But it does happen when you're boggled down with so many other things. Exactly. Anyways, long diatribe.
No, that's important. And you really broke it down. So I want to get into money, because that's something that we all face. And it's something that I speak about from a full transparent perspective with the Frugal Athlete. this is what a frugal athlete's all about. You know, how can people be more financially literate, efficient with their money, economical, prudent? So let's get into how to invest at the different stages, how to be smart about, like you said, the risk versus reward strategy or balance, but also any personal finance tips that you have, you know, getting into this space.
That's a loaded question. Let me take a breather first. There's a lot to unpack there. So I'll start with a couple and we can dive deeper accordingly, depending on like how interesting it is for your audience. First of all, I spend most of my time investing in startups. Do I have assets in mutual funds, index funds, and all that? Yes, I do. That's the vast majority of my wealth. My net worth largely in like these assets, I will never have to look at. I'm just like, hey, this is like index is going to, the S&P is going to go up like year over year of the next 10 years or 20 years. I don't have to worry about that. It's just naturally going to appreciate, right? But there are other things as an investor that I believe I have an unfair advantage, either in terms of information or in terms of hustle or in terms of relationships that I can deeply leverage. And in my case, it happens to be the world of startups, right? So first of all, any kind of startup investing in venture funds, high risk asset class. I'm going to caveat with that. And I'm sure you'll probably have this disclaimer somewhere, but my lawyer is going to kill me if I don't say this. But anything that I'm going to share in just a few is for informational purposes and educational purposes only. It's not legal advice. Go consult a legal counselor for this.
Yeah. So for the audience, don't come on the podcast or don't come try and say, well, David said this or Moby said that. So this is what I did. This is for educational and informational purposes only. Consult with your team, do your due diligence. But thank you so much, David. Continue, please.
So after prefacing with that, how to invest in high-risk things. One, you will not have that much information compared to others. Like compared to the public markets where you have everything's measured there, like you're going to have at best like 5-6 metrics that people are going at. And if you're like, how many customers do they have? They have like 3 to 5 customers at best. If not, they just secured their first customer, right? So there's a lot of qualitative information you have to evaluate. How I think about it, this is actually something my friends named, I have this like thesis called the NTY thesis. Didn't name it, my friends named it. NTY, if you're in the younger millennial Gen Z talk, NTY stands for no thank you. How I think about it is N stands for why now, T stands for why this, U stands for why you. And at each stage in which you're evaluating a company, you should be looking at something different. So I'll expand on 2 different wavelengths. One, there are 3 kinds of ideas as a first check investor. So I'll caveat with I'm a first check investor. If you're looking for a seed investor, Series A investor, OB, you're connected with a bunch of folks there. I'm sure they'll offer better advice there. But if you're trying to get in early before an institutional investor comes in, there are 3 kinds of ideas. One, there's plausible ideas. 2, they're possible ideas. 3, they're preposterous ideas. And each with increasing ludicrousness, so to speak, right? Plausible ideas are, this is an obvious idea. You tell this to anyone, they're like, of course this should exist in the market, right? It's a no-brainer. And because it's so obvious to so many people, the most important question the founder has to answer is why this? And why this usually comes down to traction. Do they have traction that is significantly better than other folks? So for example, I invest in consumer, right? Most consumer apps fall below like, you know, maybe like 2 at best 3 times of usage in a given week, right? But if you meet a founder that's like, has an app that people are using 4 or 5 times a week, that's really sexy as an investment, right? Other times it's like daily active to monthly active. Most people probably sit at anywhere between like 20 to 25%. But if you can talk to a founder that nails like daily active to monthly active by 50%, which means 50% of their monthly active users use their product daily, that's also really interesting. So if it's a very plausible idea, it's obvious to everyone else, you need to focus on the traction, right? Because where users go, that's the moat itself, right? That's the differentiation, right? That's 1. 2, I mentioned possible ideas. Possible ideas are like, okay, I could see this working out, but I don't know if anyone would buy this. Like it logically makes sense to me, but I can't see why anyone would buy this. That comes down to a timing risk, right? Market timing risk. And so the question is why now? And so if you're up against a possible idea where it's like, okay, people can largely agree like, okay, I can see where this is going, but people aren't sure like if this is the time for it now or for past the market timing or like where we have yet to get to the market timing. The question is like, the founder has to really answer, why is now a good time to be investing, right? Uber became really successful, not because they did a marketplace or they were doing arbitrage for regulation. Uber became really successful because the smartphone came around that time. And the GPS, for the first time in forever, was actually very accurate, at least within the span of, like, I don't know, it was like a couple feet radius or a couple yards radius, right? And because GPS was so accurate, that's why Uber was able to be successful. It's with the advent of the technology of a smartphone. And it wouldn't have been able to succeed if we were in the 2000 era, because people were still on their personal computers and all that, right? Yep. And so thinking about market timing is really important for possible ideas. The third of which is preposterous ideas. And if it's a preposterous idea, then it's like, well, if it's absolutely crazy and most people would say no, the founder really has to convince you that why them? So why you, right? Yeah. And so the why you kind of thesis really is like, okay, maybe they're like normally a reasonable person, very logical person, but if they're willing to stake their reputation to sound just a little crazy, but to back that up by logic, they might be worth listening to. And so that's like a preposterous idea. And that's really like a touchy-feely kind of thing. Everyone has their own goalpost for the quality bar. But the question is like, why you is one, do they have some insight that I haven't heard before? And then two, can they attract other people, not just me, to also believe in that idea? That could be early customers, that could be early team members, and that could be, you know, just like early investors as well, which includes myself. If it's early team members or early customers, but more so early team members, one of the questions I like asking, assuming they've hired people before, is have you ever laid someone off, or have you ever fired someone that you regretted? Because then they know what their quality bar is. Because if you've laid someone off, you're like, oh, of course I should have laid them off. And to this day, you're still like, okay, I should have laid them off. Then that was a really low bar. Like, you don't know where, like, you don't struggle with where quality stands, right? But if you've laid someone off and a month later, 2 months later, you're like, oh, actually, I probably should have kept them, but I might've been a little bit emotional, or the business wasn't doing as well during that 3 weeks, 4 weeks that I made that decision. Then you know, like, in the future, not to make that mistake ever again, right? And the thing we say in venture all the time is A players hire A players, B players hire C players. And the reason for that, A players recognize other A players, right? Yeah. B players, they're like, okay, they know they're good, but they're not, they also know they're not as good as an A player. But B players, they never want to be usurped, right? They don't want to be like outdone. And so they will hire someone who's just a little worse than they are. And that happens to be C players. And so A players can tolerate B players, but they can't tolerate C players, right? And so at that point, you have all the A players leave the company, and you'll be left with Bs and Cs. And you never want a company that's only left with Bs and C players, right? And exactly. So recognizing when someone is an A player, when they can recognize other A players, they can attract other A players to join their team, is actually really important as well. Anyways, that's one wavelength of qualitative things. The second thing that I tell a lot of emerging angels or people who want to think about investing in venture is the first 50 startups you see, do not invest in any of them. I don't care how good they are. I don't care like how you came across them. I don't care who referred them to you. Do not invest in a single one of them.
I'll write that down.
Yeah. The reason I say that is when you're starting off, you have no idea what quality looks like. You ask the average like 10-year investor and it's like, hey, you know, what does intuition look like? Oh, intuition, I built this up over 20 whatever plus years. But you, when you're beginning, have no idea what intuition is. And so the goal of the first 50 kind of companies you see is to train and build up your own intuition. So what happens is your first 50 companies, rank them from 1 through 50. To be honest, you don't have to rank them past like the 10, like rank your first 10, right? Why you're ranking them first 10, why you would rank them that way. What is your calculus for investing? Like thinking about this is the first place, this is the second place, this is the third place. And the first company you see that is as good or better than your first place company after your first 50 companies, that's when you should start thinking about making that investment. And to be fair, and this is true in the venture world as well, no matter how good you think your first 50 are, no matter how good they are, you're gonna make mistakes in the early days. I made my first check, my first angel check, the company went bellies up 6 months after I invested, right? I like didn't know what I was doing. But at the same time, I thought at the time, I know who I'm investing in. So you're going to make mistakes, and usually a critical mass or portfolio size or a sample size of 30 investments is usually good enough for you to like actually start understanding. So after the first 50, don't invest any of them. Then make your next 30 investments. Don't invest in the next 30 companies. Just like pick 30 companies out of the hundreds, hopefully thousands you see. And then after that, then you'll start having some intuition of like, okay, this is what good looks like. This is what great looks like. And usually that portfolio size of 30, 40 is when you can start having some early outliers in your investments as well. So that's generally how I think about it. Hopefully that's helpful to your audience.
No, this is helpful. And I really appreciate you. Like, I have a whole playbook of notes that I walked away with. So I know the audience is going to walk away with something as well. Before we close, do you have any like last piece of advice for, you know, we've spoke a couple times, you've worked with athletes, you've been an athlete. One piece of advice that you would have for athletes as it pertains to building, becoming that, as I like to call it, an athlete CEO. Before we close, like, what would be your like takeaway piece of advice?
Work with people or be friends with people who scare you. I think it's really important. If you're playing at the world-class level or you're playing at this very competitive class and you can recognize what talent is, your body knows. That's what early intuition is. If someone scares you just by how amazing they are and they're like, they feel like a threat to your business or they feel like a threat to like, you know, your future success and all that, get to know them really well because there's something in your body that's telling you that they're really good. And it's your job to figure out why they're really good and how you can implement it into your own life as well. I see a lot of athletes, like not everyone, but a lot of people, they come out of the top of their game. They're like, you know, I'm the best. And they go around thinking that they're the best, but there's always a mountain that's higher than the hill that you're on, right? And it may not be in your industry, might be in another industry, but stick to people who scare you and stick to people who teach you things, even if unbeknownst they teach you things, because you're naturally going to grow a lot with them. And one thing I like thinking about in the world, and this doesn't matter if you're becoming a CEO or otherwise, there are three kinds of mentors you should always take on. Peer mentors, tactical mentors, strategic mentors. Peer mentors are people who are in like the trenches with you, right? They're learning as much as you're learning, but it's a great like circle, mastermind circle that you're building together and you can learn from each other. Two, tactical mentors, they're 2-3 years ahead of you in the industry that you want to build on. They can provide you the tactical insights and also check your blind side because they just went through it. And there's strategic mentors who are like 10 plus years ahead of you or like they've reached the level of success you would like to reach in, given your current goal. And they've forgotten what it's like to be in the trenches, right? They're not going to check their blinds. They forgot what the blind side looks like, right? But they can keep you centered. They can keep you, this is what your North Star is, and it can keep you focused on your North Star and often accountable towards your North Star as well. So having mentors in each of those categories is very helpful in no matter what industry you're in.
Well, I could write a whole blog on what we spoke about, man. This was amazing, David. And I'm sure we're going to get together again soon. We're both in NorCal. But for anyone that wants to follow you, we're going to have your show notes. I mean, sorry, your website, Cup of Zoe.
You're good. You're good.
Yeah, Cup of Zoe. We're going to have that. But if anyone wants to connect with you, how can they do so?
So I'm active on almost every platform, Perks of Investing in Consumer Social. But to be like most responsive, I think I'm most responsive either via my blog, if you reach out there, or on LinkedIn. So if you find me on LinkedIn, it's like linkedin.com/in/DavidJZHOU, my last name.
Perfect. And we'll have that in the show notes as well. But David, thank you so much. Best of luck with your card game that will be determined soon. I'm just excited to continue to develop our relationship. But also, you know, continue learning. So appreciate you for taking the time. There you have it, folks. David, what a wonderful guest. As you know, this is what a frugal athlete is all about. Key stakeholders or athletes talking about how to be efficient, economical, financially prudent. If you do not mind, please rate, subscribe, send to a friend. It helps us continue to find wonderful guests on the show. We'll catch you at the next episode.
Thank you for tuning into this podcast episode. For more information, check out the show notes and go to our website, www.afrugalathlete.com. If you enjoyed, please leave a favorable rating and review and share and subscribe. Thank you so much.